Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the GeoMob Podcast. My guest today was a speaker at our recent Berlin event. Carsten Hernke is here to tell us about Honeycomb Maps. He gave a very interesting talk at our Berlin event in late February. And lots of lessons I thought that are applicable. So I wanted to get him on the podcast here so he could share his story specifically, but also the kind of the general concepts that I think many people would benefit. Carsten, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for speaking in Berlin, and thanks for coming on the show. Why don't you introduce yourself and you know, let's dive right into what exactly Honeycomb Maps is.
Thanks so much for having me, Ed. I'm super excited to be on this podcast. So my name is Carsten. I'm the founder of Honeycomb Maps. Honeycomb is a geospatial data analysis tool built around H3 that runs completely in the browser with WebAssembly. So right now we have logistics and mobility companies using Honeycomb to design and manage their zones.
What I like particularly about your talk, Carsten, is it started with kind of the story of you going to work at some startup and, you know, being assigned the task of building some complex geospatial application. And why don't you briefly retell that story and the kind of aha moment after you completed the project, because I think it's a story that many software developers can relate to, but particularly in geospatial can relate to.
Yes. So I'm originally from the States, from Minnesota, and I was working in technology consulting in the States. But I had this interest in geospatial ever since I took a class in university. But I was really looking for an opportunity to do geospatial and get paid for it. Right. So this opportunity opened up over here in Berlin at a micro-mobility startup. And the team I was on was part of the data organization, and we were responsible for taking a lot of the data from our fleet of vehicles, combining it with maybe some third-party data, some different feeds, and then creating tools for stakeholders within the company, and then external partners like cities. And so one of these projects I was working on was deploying this new internal geospatial visualization tool. And so we would be able to pull data from our data warehouse. We were using Snowflake and make maps of all of our vehicles over time, overlaid with app open data, overlaid with the street network. And I was finally doing geospatial. I thought this was super cool. And then we released it to some of our internal users, and it kind of fell flat, which, you know, was a bit interesting. We would try to get them onboard them, show them how to use the tool, and they would kind of nod along and say, hey, this is really nice, the map looks great, but we just didn't see that our users were super engaged with it. In fact, I shared this anecdote during my talk, but we got a bit of the request to add a button so I can download a CSV of the data, which is, you know, I put all this work into making this nice map, and then they just want a CSV download, right?
Very,
so they can put it in Excel.
Very frustrating, I can imagine, because you worked on this for weeks or months, if I understood correctly, right? And see,
yeah, it was about 6 months of finding platforms, talking to vendors, setting it all up. Yeah.
So I think everyone can relate to that experience of, you know, you get the assignment, you dive into the tools, you got to understand the data, clean up the data, deal with all the edge cases, and you finally produce this amazing tool, and then and they just want a CSV file. So, So what was the conclusion from that, Carsten? What did you learn, and what action did that then lead to?
So I started thinking, why aren't these internal users gravitating towards the tool? Because there were a lot of internal tools that our teams loved or used very frequently. Things like Google Sheets or Excel. The finance and operations teams were almost exclusively running on these massive Google Sheets with all these edits and all this business logic. And there were even a lot of mapping tools that were being used internally. There was pretty high usage of Kepler GL, the open source visualization tool. And we even saw people that would download data from Looker in CSV format and then drag it into Kepler. So it wasn't that these internal users didn't like to use web-based tools or, you know, didn't like to do their job with a computer. I think it ended up coming down to the way that we were presenting the information and the geospatial experience we had created for them just wasn't fitting their needs. And we can talk a little bit more about why that is.
Well, please do. Because I thought in your talk at GMOB Berlin, I thought you got some key insights that, you know, you could see everyone in the audience kind of nodding along with around this kind of idea of the direct manipulation. And please go into that.
Yeah. So I realized a lot. I did a bit more research and learning about user interfaces and what makes a compelling user experience. And I came across this idea of direct manipulation, and it really resonated with me. The idea of direct manipulation is an interface technique where a user is interacting directly with objects on a screen, typically by clicking or dragging, and they're getting feedback in real time. And that's in, I guess you could contrast that with something like a command-based interface, where users are entering different commands, something like a terminal.
Right.
Direct manipulation interfaces are by far and away the most common user interface, and the vast majority of people are super comfortable with these interfaces and use them many times a day. Things like pinch to zoom on an iPhone, swipe to unlock. You know, you're interacting with a device and then you're getting real-time feedback. And something I realized and learned about is that to make that direct manipulation magic happen, you need to be responding and giving visual feedback to your user within 80 milliseconds, or about 1/10 of 1 second. And so I realized a lot of geospatial tooling, including the internal tool we had built, didn't hit that 80-second mark. As the user was using the tool, they would click on something, and then they would wait for the map to load. And that really gave this kind of jerky, slow, non-responsive experience that frustrated the user and led them to maybe trust the tool less or be less drawn to using this tool.
Well, this is the problem, man. Our attention spans have been so eroded that, you know, if the tool doesn't respond almost instantaneously, you know, people are like, oh, well, let me go check Reddit or you know, like, they just don't. It's exactly the case. People want instantaneous response, or else they move. You know, they get bored. They start to get distracted, and you know, as you noted in your talk, it's very difficult to do that instantaneous response in the classic client server model, particularly with huge amounts of data. So what's the solution?
Exactly, it's a sense of control for the user. If we get the sense that and when we do click something, it will respond in a way that's predictable instantaneously, that gives us a sense of control that's very comforting.
So now you have this aha moment. So what's the solution? How do we solve it?
So I started thinking about how could we make this geospatial data analysis experience much more responsive and get to this 80 milliseconds of direct manipulation. And that's when I came across a new technology called WebAssembly. So WebAssembly is a relatively new browser technology that lets different types of code run in the browser. So traditionally, you would write, if you were developing a web application, you would have your HTML, which would have the site content. Then you would have CSS, which would be the styling for the site, things like fonts and colors. And then you would have JavaScript, which would be your interaction logic.
Yeah.
And you can do a lot with JavaScript, but the fact is most geospatial libraries aren't written in JavaScript. A lot of the foundational work is in C, C++. There's a lot in Python, a lot in R. But what WebAssembly does is now it lets you pull in these .wasm or WASM WebAssembly files and lets your browser run those as well. So thinking about this, it was a bit of an aha moment for me because rather than a user interacting with a web application in the browser that's constantly sending requests to a backend and introducing this latency and lag, now with WebAssembly, we can actually move that computation and processing logic into the browser and just cut out all of that latency and lag to provide a much more fluid interactive experience.
So wait, explain this to me. So I write my software, let's say I write it in Python or whatever, and then I convert it into WebAssembly, and then I send all the WebAssembly to the browser. Is that it? When the user initially loads the application? Is that kind of the model? And at that point, it's all in the browser, and it's all running there. And I presumably need to also ship all the data to the browser.
Yes, that's correct. So WebAssembly is... And I don't want to get too wonky here because I'm also not a browser developer, that side of things. But WebAssembly is a compilation target. So if you have a compiled language like C, you need to compile it before it will run, right? And typically you will compile it for a certain architecture.
Definitely.
WebAssembly is an alternate compilation target. So you can now build your... Let's say you have a function that does like a st contains. You could build that function for WebAssembly, and all browsers now ship the technology that lets that run that WebAssembly file. But you described it exactly correctly, is that you are shipping the logic to the client, and then you are shipping the data to the client as well, and then that computation is happening in the browser on the client side. So the benefits are much faster response time because you're on the client side. You also have some benefits around security because there's fewer places the data needs to go to reach the user. But then drawbacks, you have to get the data and get the bundle to the client. And then you also need to that could limit the size of computation you can do, right? Because you're no longer on a server somewhere where you can scale up. You're on a client device that probably doesn't have as much processing power.
So I guess I'm trading a much or potentially larger startup time or the fact that then once it's started up in the user's browser on the client side, everything's much simpler and faster. Is that basically it?
Yep.
And the right, so as you say, it's a compile target. So I, as a software developer, I'm not writing WebAssembly. I'm working in some other language, and then I compile it into WebAssembly. And that's fairly straightforward, or is this, is that a mature technology at this point?
Fairly straightforward is maybe a bit generous. There is some tooling out there. So if you're writing, say, in C, C++, Rust, there's a tool called mscripten that will handle that compilation process for you largely.
Yeah.
And then it will give you essentially a JavaScript wrapper for your WebAssembly WASM functions. There's also, if you're in Python, There is a tool. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but we'll put it in the show notes. There is a tool where they have essentially pre-compiled a Python binary to WebAssembly so it can run right in the browser. And then you, then because Python isn't exactly compiled, you already have the Python runtime compiled, and then you could just run your
Python code in the browser. And the browsers are pretty standardized on this. I mean, I as someone who has lived through years of fiddling with CSS and JS to make, you know, because Firefox does it differently than Internet Explorer used to do, than, you know, Chrome used to do. How standardized is this on the browser side?
So this actually really surprised me. As I was reading about it, I thought it was this experimental, upcoming, maybe it will be included, maybe it won't feature. But all four of the major browser engines have fully supported WebAssembly since 2018, I believe. And you see some adoption in tools that you probably have used or use every day. Figma, for example, does all of its logic and computation using WebAssembly. So that's how they get this really fluid, interactive drawing and design experience in browser. They use WebAssembly.
Okay. And so this is what Honeycomb Maps does. So your business is focused on using WebAssembly to create these smooth geospatial experiences, or tell us exactly what your, you know, after learning about this new technology, how did you then turn that into a business?
Yeah. So we took some of these ideas around WebAssembly and processing on the browser side, and then also took some of the problems that I saw from a geospatial tooling perspective, and specifically saw the rise of H3 and the need for an opinionated, user-friendly interface to interact with H3. Our application right now is running completely in the browser. It can take in points or pre-aggregated H3 indexes. It will display them on a very nice heat map that's interactive as you zoom in and zoom out. It will adjust to H3 level. And then another core need I saw in the market, and something a lot of our customers are excited about, is the ability to import, edit, and then save zones. And something new that I think Honeycomb brings to the market is the ability to bring in different zones. These could be, for example, delivery zones. Bring in points, delivery points, and then we do the aggregation from those points up to those zones in real time. So that allows the user to edit the zones and get real-time feedback on the number of packages in that zone. For example, the average weight, the total weight, all these different statistics of the zone, and then can save that back.
So what is the typical use case there? I'm imagining something like I'm trying to assign tasks to drivers or something like that. Is that kind of where this application would be useful? Or give me an example of like who are, what types of people need this type of technology?
Yep. We're focused specifically on the mobility and last mile delivery markets right now. And our first product, we're calling it Zone Manager. And it's really designed for operations teams to use. So the end user is somebody who might be working as a manager of a warehouse and needs to allocate packages onto different trucks and wants to make sure that each truck is covering a zone that has an equal number of packages.
Got it.
And so it's I think it's a bit different from some other geospatial tooling because it's not, you could say it's not as powerful, but it's not quite meant to be do everything completely. It's very different from like a QGIS, for example, that would take a lot of training and might be a bit too heavy for some of these operational cases. It's built for somebody who maybe doesn't have a geospatial background, but can get a lot of value out of these geospatial techniques.
Yeah, I've seen this more and more with these. I mean, two observations. First of all, I think coming out of COVID and the boom of delivery services and kind of real-time delivery, I mean, we're seeing a lot of new startups that are kind of working to build the tools to make that work for these different companies, you know, be it on the routing side, be it on, you're doing more on the analysis side, be it on, you know, address cleaning, helping people do the, you know, all the data that's around deliveries, processing that data, finding the mistakes and things like that. It seems like there's really a lot happening in this space, particularly in Berlin. So hopefully we'll get a few more interesting startups speaking at future GeoMob Berlins about this. But very exciting. But your second point is very well made, that, you know, one of the problems in my opinion, in the rise of these FOSS tools like QGIS or whatever, they've become so amazingly powerful that, you know, they can do everything. And as a result, it's a very overwhelming if you're new to these tools. You know, exactly. If you don't have a formal, GIS background, you go in there and there's just so many menus and sub-menus, and it's a bit too much. It's a bit too much.
It's not to say that they are extremely powerful tools, and you can unlock a ton of value if you know what you're doing with them. But I think the amount of people in an organization that have that skill set and have that time in their day and everything to boot up QGIS and start solving problems, I would make the argument that that is much, much smaller than the number of people who are maybe closer to the business operations, an operation manager trying to apportion things onto trucks.
Well, and the thing is,
but that's still a geospatial problem that they need to be solved.
Exactly. Yeah, but you can imagine, you know, the operations manager, that guy has, you know, 100 different things going on in his day, right? The last thing, he doesn't have time to go into submenu 3 and figure out how all these little details work. And I think it's easy to sympathize with someone in that position, and you can see how they then retreat to the position of, oh, well, just send me a CSV and I'll figure it out in the tool that I already know, which is Excel or whatever. And
right.
So you got to really, you know, it's so hard to make something simple and to resist the temptation to add more bells and whistles and more, you know, oh, it could do this or it could do that or whatever. And this is something I really think people in the geospatial world need to understand, is that, you know, it's just a tool that people want to use to get their job done. And the vast majority of people are not as excited about geospatial as we are. Or even if they are as excited, they just don't have the time. And so you need to think about, how do you keep your tool as simple as possible? And you know, one thing we talk a lot about in my business, Kirsten, is we're totally into it, and we spend all day thinking about it and all these little edge cases and all the little features we could add. And for the vast majority of customers, they think about our tool, our service, and probably your tool and all the geospatial tools. They think about it the way you think about the power company. Like, when they flip the light switch, the lights would go on. And otherwise, they don't want to think about it, right? And that's it. And it's just a tool for them. They don't want to, you know, go deeper than that. So,
yep. And then it's how do you communicate the advantages and benefits of your tool in the language of the customer?
Oh, yes.
So and the customer's problems. Because I actually don't, if you go to the Honeycomb website, there's maybe one or two mentions of WebAssembly, because I think it's fascinating and unlocks a potential whole new paradigm for data and interacting with data. But I don't think my customers really care how it works under the hood. They just want to drag the edge of a zone and then see another number on the screen.
Correct. They just want the light to go on when they flip the switch, and that's it. They couldn't care less how it happens. So, Well, thanks very much for telling us your story here, Carson. How long have you been working on this, and how is it going so far? I mean, how are you finding running your own geospatial business here?
It's pretty great. We've been going for about, I think some of the first commits were made about a year ago, and then formalized things and got incorporated as a company last summer, so about 8-9 months ago. And now we have some customers, we have revenue coming in. So that was a huge milestone to hit.
Yeah, congrats.
To show that.
You've accomplished. The hardest part is getting started and overcoming the inertia and, taking the steps to formalize it and things like that. And obviously getting even the first customer is a huge milestone. So that's fantastic. Congrats.
Thank you. And now we're in a process of, some of the first customers have been just tremendous in giving us feedback on what they want to see and how to improve the product. And we're really in the process of refining, improving, and then acquiring new customers who could also benefit from our technology. So, I'd encourage everybody to go to honeycombmaps.com if this is interesting, and definitely feel free to reach out to myself and get in touch.
If
there's anything we can help
what
you
type with. Of companies would be your ideal customer? Who should be contacting you at this stage? If any listeners out there.
Yeah, I would. The customer persona I think about is myself in my previous role. So I was on a data team. We had a lot of latitude, longitude data, in this case from these GPS units on our scooters. Yep. And we had some existing BI tooling. We had Looker, but we weren't really using that location data to the level that we could. And we were also in a position where we were trying to create tools for operations teams. So if you're at a company where you have all this location data and your business is there's a significant spatial component to your business, whether you're delivering things or getting people around. Maybe Honeycomb's interesting to you.
Okay. Well, I encourage everyone out there listening to have a look at it. Likewise, if people are more interested in WebAssembly, what any good resources you can mention that they should check out or have? As someone who knows very little about WebAssembly, how can I kind of dip my toe in the water? What would you recommend there?
Yeah, it's a young technology. I think it's a bit, because it runs in the browser, I think there's at least a basic level of front-end knowledge that you need. So I would encourage people to read up on kind of your basic web app 101s. I would also give a plug to a new database technology called DuckDB. That's actually how I learned about WebAssembly. I was reading about DuckDB. It's a in-process analytical database. And then I noticed there was a compilation of DuckDB to WebAssembly. And so that then kind of gives you all the power of a database in WebAssembly. Yes, so that was my gateway to learning about it. And that can be probably interesting for some people listening as well.
Okay. Well, I encourage listeners to check that out. And of course, they should check out your site. And hopefully, you'll be able to attend a future GeoMob Berlins, and they can say hello if they are able to make it there. So,
of course.
I appreciate you taking the time, Carson. If someone does want to get in touch directly, what's the best way for them to do that?
Send me an email, reach out on LinkedIn. Yeah.
Okay.
Always happy to have a chat.
Thanks very much, Carson. And thanks for speaking in Berlin, but also congrats. It's always cool to hear a story of someone starting out with a new company, a new journey, and having success with that. So congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks, Ed, for GeoMob and kind of everything you do for the geospatial spatial community.
My pleasure, Carson. Well, I will see you at the next GeoMob Berlin, which actually we have now scheduled. So it's going to be June 5th. So hopefully you can make it there. as
sounds great. Listen. I'll be there.
All right, take it easy. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today and listening to the GeoMob podcast. Hope you enjoyed the discussion. Get in touch with us if you have any feedback or suggestions for topics we should cover. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly mailing list where we keep you informed about upcoming events. You can, of course, also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is GeoMob. Thanks for listening, and hope to see you at a GeoMob event soon.